Now let me introduce Scott Boylston. Scott is he's a professor of sustainability design and graphic design at the Savannah College of Art and Design in Savannah, Georgia. And he is also a board member of the Georgia Board of the United States Green Building Council. And I thought it would be very, very interesting to see what a sister institution was doing, the kind of challenges that they've run into, and how they've resolved these. So, Scott, I turn this over to you.
Okay, well, thank you, Elaine. Thank you, everybody, for being here and also for organizing this. And I want to start by saying that I think anyone who's been involved with sustainability knows how long it's taken to get to this point. And the struggle has been frustrating and difficult, and sometimes seems like it goes backward more than it goes forward. So I'm thrilled to be here to talk about this because I think, being somewhat of an optimist, I think that what we're witnessing is a congealing of a lot of thinking that has been laid for us over the last 40 years or so. And I'm just, like I said, so I'm very happy to be here to talk about this with you. Elaine had asked me to talk. We went back and forth with some outlines, and she wanted to make sure that I talked a little about some of our ups and downs in developing the Design for Sustainability program, some of the concrete experiences and some of the details of the program, because I think what we'll see, and I think we're already seeing this, but I think what we'll see over the next, say, 10 years is a diverse array of sustainable design programs. Some will be very heavy in the hard sciences. Some will be perhaps heavier in, say, social innovation and the soft sciences. And I think we'll hit another plateau, say, in 10 years or so, where we'll all come together and we'll start to say, okay, well, what's worked and what hasn't? So I see this as part of a long continuum, and it's an exciting time. The word here that you may or may not agree with or may not be surprised to see is the word movement, because I'm going to keep coming back to that time and again, because there's a lot of discussions of, well, no, we have to do this. Well, no, we have to do that. And the answer always is we have to do them all, and we have to do them in the right order, and we have to do them when it's necessary to do them. So before I get into what some of the things that we've been doing down in Savannah, little old Savannah, I want to show you just some slides that I took while I was in Chennai. This is, I think, about 3 years ago, and some pictures of design. Now, my background is fiction and graphic design and package design and a mess of other things. So this was more of a conference not on design at all, but on sustainability. And we were given a lot of tours of some of the slums in Chennai. And as I walked around before some of these tours, I saw this billboard. So coming from graphic design, I could see this being taught as exquisite design. Now, I mean, you know, we could quibble about the typeface and all that, but, you know, you see this beautiful curve on the P mimicking the ring, and we could see where within a class and within the industry, people can become convinced that talking about the formal aspects of this leads everybody to believe that it's strong, it's good, right? Okay, so this is a river, and downtown Chennai was right over here, and there's a highway here. So this was intended to communicate to an audience that was either in like a tuk-tuk or a car, somewhat well off. What you don't see is this, and because I couldn't get in the lens, all of this over here, there's a city on the river. Now, it's not a city, it's a slum. People are drinking out of this river, which is not a river, it's a sewer. And they are cleaning their clothes, they are drinking, they're living their lives in this area. And every day, that's what they see. They see a white woman. I'm sorry, she's Indian, but she's white. Right? This is what we're communicating as designers to this particular audience. On the same trip, when we took a tour of the slums, this is the whole house. Now, you can't see this side here, right? This is a doorway, and the rest of the house, which is only one room, was a wall here and a wall there. There's a little kind of wash basin over here. We spent a few hours there talking and working with the people. So it was a little awkward taking pictures, but they were more than happy, it seemed, to lead us through the slum, and they're actually very proud of it. The sewer ran right about here. It was under some brick and so on. There's a TV and posters of a life that child will never have. And on that TV were programs designed about people who that kid will never meet. So all of this is designed, right? This is what we do as designers. The question is, what's happening? When we talk about design, we talk about design. One way of saying it is that we are defining a range of options. Right? We define, when is it green? Is it black? Is it high heels? Is it low shoes? Is it a modern building? Does it have a certain artifice on it? These are all options that are defining so many things. My question, and I think all of our questions here, is what range of options are we defining when we have a child who that was 3 years ago. He'll be a teenager in 3 or 4 years. He'll be watching that show and living within this world, this artifice, as a spectator. How is he going to feel 5 years from now, 10 years from now? And more importantly, what's going to happen, right, to that culture? What's happening now? But what are the options that we as designers are laying out here? That's what we should be doing, right? Buckminster Fuller, anticipatory design science, back in 1920. Where has that gone? What could we anticipate the outcomes here? And anybody who knows anything about what's happening in the environment with the ecology knows that we really have defined, and I won't blame all designers, right? Or I won't just blame design. I don't think that would be right. But as a part of this larger system, we're defining two different options here. One is these people here, they'll get that. And they'll get this. And the world will literally collapse. You could argue that it's collapsing now. But environmentally, ecologically, it cannot be sustained. The promises that we're making cannot be sustained, period. It's very simple. The other option, of course, is revolution. Right? If they don't get that, if we can't deliver on these promises that we're putting out there, well, that child who's going to be a teenager soon is going to start, if not already, the process of self-hate, self-questioning, eventual anger. So these are the options, I think, that our culture has been defining for far too long. And many would argue that it's not really an option of A or B. It will be both. It will be both. So those are the options that we're laying out for society. What about the options we lay out for ourselves? Right? As designers. Do we really have options when we're teaching? This is Ezio Manzini, one of my personal heroes. This is something that he said. When there is no room for choice because the solution is dictated by strong social conventions and or technological constraints, there's no design. So not only is there no choice within communities and societies, but there's really no design happening. We're designing in a very circumscribed way. Right? We're limiting our choices de facto because we have gotten caught up in our present system of overconsumption and globalization. This is a patent, and this I'm from New York, but I moved to Savannah about 10 years ago, and I love it. It's great. It's a beautiful town. Savannah, you may or may not know, is a home of a lot of technological innovations. One of them is this. This is the cotton gin. This is the patent for the cotton gin, 1794. That's design. Right? He's an inventor. You could call him an engineer. You could call him anything you want, but it's product design. Right, okay. So he has his own museum. He's Eli Whitney. He's heralded as quite a designer. At the time that he submitted this, 1794, there were 700,000 slaves in America, in North America. Right? Less than 50 years later, there were 3.6 million slaves. And now, once again, I'm not trying to simplify. I'm just posing some things to think about. And I have actually a quote from his very own museum about this. We are designing things once again, circumscribed by some of the things that are happening within a culture that are dictated by power holders' interests. Right? So what about the consequences? And this is from his, I won't read it all, but this is from his museum. Whitney could not have foreseen the ways in which his invention would change society for the worse. The most significant of these was the growth of slavery. While it was true that the cotton gin reduced the labor of removing seeds, it did not reduce the need for slaves to grow and pick the cotton. In fact, the opposite occurred. Cotton growing became so profitable for the planters that it greatly increased their demand for both land and slave labor. And then it goes on to say the numbers that I shared with you. And that by 1860, one in three Southerners was a slave. So, like I said, we can't really blame all of that on the cotton gin, but we should ask ourselves, do we want to teach our students in a way where if they do something spectacular in society at that moment, 50, 100 years later, that they're going to have this as a part of their legacy? Do we want to be teaching that way? Right? I think it's an important question to ask. So, our program, which is very new, it's not science based per se. It's not design based per se. It's systems based. And I think, you know, here too, everybody agrees, I think, within this room. But what we're looking at is not necessarily facilitating creative solutions within systems in crisis. I think we're beyond that. I think some of the things I've already said, we're dealing with systems of crisis. We're dealing with systems that actually embody crisis after crisis after crisis. So how do we work there? How do we try to rather than, quote-unquote, fix a system that's in crisis, how do we create solutions that can address systems of crisis? It's a really important question. So what I'm going to do here, I'm just going to briefly lay out what we're doing, and then I'm going to talk more specifically about how we're doing it, right? Like, literally, what's happening on the ground. So there's the MFA program. The orange type are classes that are, this is a two-year MFA, outside of the design teaching realm. And then what you see in terms of the gray are the classes that are specifically sustainable design. So this would be we work on quarter systems. There's three quarters every year. It's pretty tough to manage because things are happening so fast, but that's the way it is. So we have a very strong class, a foundation of globalization and global the theories and speaking about postmodernism, Foucault and so on. And that's outside. This is taught by a PhD who I think she did her doctorate in the consumer culture of diamonds. A very critical look at that. And like I said, I really just want to give you a snapshot of this, if that's okay, rather than going into in-depth into all of these. But I do want to point out some classes. So these would be, all right, pretty straightforward stuff. Right? I mean, that package of knowledge that's been out there and continues to mature and thicken. The materials, the principles of materials. I hope this is okay. I'm not going to talk about the theories. Right? I'm assuming that we all can agree, for the most part, what they are. I want to just talk about the larger framework. This is an important class here. Because just like some of the things, in our opinion, design leadership and environmental justice. Because when you think about the repercussions of our systems, you have to think about the developing world, like we already looked at. But you have to look at the victims, the actual victims of our limited view when we talk about product design and materials. We have an entire nation, you could say, within our nation, that has historically suffered from the waste that is produced when we make the things we make. And so environmental justice, which has a very strong foundation since the mid or early 70s, we're teaching those theories, and then they are literally getting outside the classroom, working with some environmental justice organizations to see what is really happening, and with the EPA, the regional office in Atlanta. So, like I said, these are, I think, relatively self-explanatory, some of these. The practices out in the field. I'm going to get to this, but we literally, our job, in my opinion, is to knock down the classroom walls. And then you can see the second year, design in response to crisis. We had been looking at Should we be looking at chronic as opposed to crisis? Chronic crisis, very different dynamics, a lot of different things at play. But instead we thought this is a chronic problem and it's more specific. So we went with that and then and designed in response to crisis, which I think you can imagine is sometimes hard to teach in a practical sense. So there are plenty of case studies we can look at, and we can look at the role that, say, design imperialism plays in terms of Westerners going to third world countries to try to fix solutions and actually creating more. But this is the general layout. And like I said, what I'd really like to do is talk about how we're dividing these things. Because I think this is, you know, everybody develops their own models. The technical innovation and the social innovation are very different things, but of course they do come together. The technical innovation is what you would imagine, let's say, some of the traditional sciences would be dealing with. Right? So we're looking at that. Perhaps most importantly is an understanding of what life cycle analysis is, its shortcomings, its strengths, the need for it to mature more, and then on resource productivity, the simple fact that we are so inefficient right now. I think 94%, it's around 94% of the materials required to make an artifact like this laptop are never. This is 6% here, so we're in a position where we're very, very inefficient. And resources is, you know, right out of RMI, Rocky Mountain Institute, the focus on resource productivity, a radical resource productivity. So these end in biomimicry, once again, industrial ecology, all of these major frameworks. That's the technical innovation, and we're pushing those areas hard. The meaning innovation, which really is nothing more than communication design, how you make these things meaningful, how we've come to live in a culture where the norm is very comfortable to us and acceptable, and the marginal ways of thinking are suspect and perhaps dangerous. Right, so what we're looking at, the meaning innovation, is your typical communication and media, visual communication, graphic design, and so on. And the opportunities, legitimize those alternatives. I lived in New York at a time when organic food was packaged in a way that would make anybody but the strongest willed person go like, maybe not. Right? Well, what's happened? I don't know how. We know what's happened. Design for these products has become more acceptable, right, to our senses, and there are a lot of reasons why. But we as visual communicators, as meaning makers, we can make these alternative ideas and cultures more attractive. Well, perhaps as important as debunking the product-based well-being, it's pretty easy to do if you think about it, right? We're the most depressed nation in the world, right? By some research. Most depressed nation in the world, yet we have the most material wealth, yet we believe that material wealth will bring us happiness. Right? So I think there's a lot to do in terms of debunking this notion of well-being found through material goods. The perceptual leaps, I mean, we are talking about a paradigm shift. I'll talk a little more about that in a few minutes when we get into some projects. So these are kind of the I guess you'd say it's like standard approach to what everybody's looking at. And social innovation is relatively new, but Margolin was talking about this at least 20 years ago, that we focus so much on technical innovation that the technology drives our social interaction on every level. And how come designers aren't instead facilitating different ways of communicating and living together and so on? So social innovation, I think, and that's one reason why I'm focusing on it today, is because I think it has the most opportunity to dramatically shift some viewpoints, right? All right, so social innovation, all of these are connected. You could say that that within these, and hopefully I'll be able to show it, that both of these can actually change through this. Right? If we come to understand how we should be working together as communities, these things will almost work themselves out. And that's a good thing. Sorry. I'll put that in. All right. That's technological or technical innovation, right? We look at this, we're like, okay, how can we make a better TV? How can we make a a better system of presenting things. We're doing it for them, apparently, right? For humans. Okay, so let's look at this. I'm going to go through this quickly. I'm not suggesting that we design this. Right? When we look at social innovation, we're not looking at designing society per se. Instead, what we have is a design system or a designed object and a human object, which for one resists design, but also, I mean, who would we ever be to say that should be designed? There are contingencies within. Imagine the TV here, right? So we got this TV. All of the things that are happening between the public spaces and that object are contingent upon so many variables, right? Well, the contingencies here are even more dramatic. So when we start looking at this relationship, we have to be looking at that, right? And these are emergent properties. Right, so I love Cap, Friedrich Cap. And so his discussion of emergent properties, his discussion of the need to facilitate different ways of thinking rather than demanding it, and these are some of the things he said, and these are some of the principles that we as designers need to follow. A living system cannot be controlled, it can only be disturbed. Right, we have to come to realize that we should not be in the business of controlling anything, but we do have to start sensing the system and start getting a sense of how something can be. You could call it disturbed, just vibrate a little, right? Bring it to some sense of some point of action, and creating conditions rather than giving directions. These would be guiding principles within our program. So when we talk to designers, we don't talk about giving directions. We talk about creating conditions. All right, so the question is, coming back to this, is how do you teach this navigational skill? If we're talking about designers being people who can go out and within a very complex system, within the world of wicked problems, if you will, how do we teach that, right? And I think that's a question that we're all trying to answer. How do we teach it? And I'd suggest the question here is, within complex system when confined by classroom walls, it can't be done. Right? It can't be done. Some of it can. And I'm not advocating having all classes outside. There has to be a place to come back and make sense of it in a safe place where we can invite the world in one little piece at a time. But mostly, we have to teach it in the real world as an experiential education. All right. So, just looking at it, here we have a classroom, right, and then this is the quote-unquote the real world. And these are some of the things, and we can make this, all of us can sit down, I'm sure some of you already, your little maps in terms of what can go out of the class in terms of things that are produced, other than the obvious, like objects and artifacts. These are opportunities where knowledge can be disseminated, where development can occur by going out into the world and then bringing it back in and so on, right? So that is what, let's say, the classroom has to offer society. But we also have to be looking at what's happening with this quote-unquote real world. This border here, which seems to be very strong and very real, has to be transcended. Because you have all of these things either coming into the classroom potentially or moving in and out once again inspired by Capra talking about permeable membranes. Right? Our skin is permeable. It's not solid. Every living system is a permeable membrane. Our classes usually don't. So how do we facilitate permeable membranes within the classroom? Right? Constant flow in and out and in and out. So this is my solution or our solution, and this is where, like I said, now we're going to get into some more specifics. You may not think it's the best way to do it, but I've been wrestling for the last few years is how do you create continuity? How do you make sure this full and lasting immersion, not just for the students because they move on, but for the institution and for the community and for everybody who you're trying to work with and work for. And so this is a logo for a nonprofit that has been developed in part to play the role of facilitator. And like I said, let me talk about that. continuity of access. I think you guys probably have already experienced this. You do something really fantastic, and the semester ends, and the community is like, okay, well, that was great. Now what? You know, and the students are like, oh, that was awesome. What a great experience. See you later. And whatever happened to that? Years later, they'll be like, did anything happen to that? Right? So continuity. I think we need to really, as design educators, create a system that allows for real and lasting change. Continuity. And how are those spaces negotiated? When we get to dealing with local government, let's face it, that sounds nice. It's a pain. Right? It's really, really difficult. So how do we create a structure that makes sure that that at least is always open? It's not always going to work well, but at least it's always open. And as all sustainability advocates would say, perhaps, that this is that's 200 million years of expertise. It's a sturgeon. And you usually don't see the mouth because this guy's pulling it out. And you usually see it flat, so the sturgeon looks like a regular fish. But when you actually pull its mouth out, you realize, wait a minute, it's not here. It's on the bottom. And look at that thing, right? 200 million years. That's success, right? Success. Long-lasting success. What can we learn from that? You know, when we look at biomimicry. Right? So what can we learn from that? And I think one of the things is that we're missing, and we have been for a long time, is our ability to digest the things that we make. Right? So you have, as inspiration, waste equals food, however you want to say, we need more bottom feeders. We need to train more bottom feeders. We need to talk about how bottom feeding can transcend this linear cycle. And like I said, when we try to pull out one key thing, maybe it's that. Maybe it's that, right? So how do we nurture this idea? Of course, in the end, we have to design up front, right? DFE and all of that, the compostability. We have to be able to design things that are either by design or by nature reabsorbed, right? Technical closed loops or biological closed loops. But we also, I think, have to advance our bottom feeding abilities in significant ways. It's one thing that our ecosystem does not have. And you're already seeing some of that, by the way, right? I mean, we're already seeing some really cool innovations there. All right, so now, more specifically, how do we do this, right? Elaine mentioned I was on the board of the State Board of the USCBC, and this is how much waste is created by demo and renovation every single year in the building industry. 76 million tons. That's what it is. We just haven't realized it yet. Right? We just haven't realized it yet. Now, some of us have realized it, and we don't have the tools to make it happen yet. So here, when we talk about systems, when we talk about subsidies as signals of a culture to add subsidy, the old carrot and stick through a government, right? Regulations and subsidies. We have to be looking at that. We need people up at that level addressing those things. But in the meantime, can't we create innovation through bottom feeding to make that waste into wealth? All right. So navigation of a system. How are we doing on time? We're doing okay?
Doing good.
Okay. This is getting a little bit ahead, but this is kind of the simplification of a system where an old building gets torn down in America, and that happens all the time. We have to remedy that, of course. And then in particular cases, like, say, a public property, and I'm going to talk about a public housing a development that is coming down. What you have is the money flow. So this shows where the money flows from, let's say, from the property owner. And in this case, there's a developer between the developer and the engineer. And each time that the communication goes from here to there, there's some of this going back and forth, right? This is a gross simplification. The architect lies somewhere in here, right? They have this orbit that certainly, depending on the situation, at least has some interaction with these players. But they also have interaction with these players to a degree, and that's the problem. The degree is, I think, pitiful. Now, what we have here is the question is, can we bring materials into a new building?
or because what we have right now is this would be the demo subcontractors. And yeah, they make money, right? I mean, we know 25, 30% of a building does get recycled and people make money doing it. The first question is, do we even need to be building the new buildings? Right? So that the most sustainable building is the one you don't knock down. Right? Now, and here too, I know it's more complex than that in terms of energy efficiency in Savannah. We have a lot of historic buildings, and there are a lot of people trying to figure out how do we save them and create high yield energy efficiencies while maintaining the integrity of the old buildings. It's a challenge. It's not easy. But generally speaking, we should not be knocking down the way we do. Let's just say that. We have to start reconsider how we address our building stock. This is best case scenario. 40 to 80% of the materials go right to the landfill. Right, so how do we kind of prevent that flow? How do we bring that flow up? And more importantly, and this is where when we talk about the triple bottom line, and we talk about it's not just eco, it's about culture, it's about society, right? It's not just putting it into the new building, because that new building may or may not be accessible to the majority of the public. So how do we create these materials? How do we develop a community resource? Right? If we're looking for innovation in design, how can we take stuff that people want to discard and transform the lives of people who don't usually have access to such wealth? That's the question that we're posing. I have trust down there. You've noticed that there's a lot of money signs, but there's no trust. So here we have a wicked problem, and we have a system that is dysfunctional for a lot of reasons. Collaboration, design and collaboration. We talk a lot about that, right? I mean, it's a new buzzword, right? Collaboration. And it's often, well, let's collaborate on my terms. You know, right? I mean, that's how it comes across, either explicitly just like that, or through a lot of resistance. Right? Well, I know better. I'm this guy, and I know how my business works. These silos of information and knowledge. I know how this works. And you know, if the developer is going to tell the property owner to do this or to do that, wait, I'm the expert. It doesn't work that way. Right? So collaboration. It's a beautiful word. We fall short. We fall short because we allow the conflict, the inherent conflicts, and these are egos, these are monetary, they're all of those to get in the way. So collaboration, I think, is the wrong word. And forgive me for being cheeky, but I think we have to redefine it. In other words, if the word collaboration fails, and it does often. Now, don't get me wrong, it does sometimes. We need to remind people that conflict is inherent within collaboration. Right? It's inherent. It's a part of it. Because everybody wants to collaborate until it's a problem. So maybe we just change the words. Conflict collaboration. Where people, everybody knows, yes, it's collaboration, but guess what? There's going to be a lot of flack. There's going to be a lot of discomfort, a lot of conflict. So, you know, kind of playful there. All right, now, moving on to details here. This is our role, and I've played this dual role as professor, but also leading this nonprofit, is to address the dynamics in each of these areas. And it is about this, right? Innovation, innovation, innovation. Innovating relationships to optimize. Right? Not maximize a single flow. Not maximize the profiteer or maximize a profiteer or even maximize the energy in this one area, but to optimize everything throughout the system. Right? So, once again, how do we do that through design? And there's Savannah right here. We don't get hurricanes, which is kind of nice because we're tucked in there. And that's where I am. And there is this this property. Now, I won't go into the whole story, but this is downtown, the historic district, what everybody's familiar with. Gorgeous, gorgeous buildings. Very well off. People, a lot of tourists through here and so on. And there's a neighborhood over here that in the mid-90s, a lot of developers saw, and they're like, cha-ching, let's just knock everything down and build huge condos and sell them for $500,000 to $800,000. The city of Savannah, to their credit, saw that happening. Now, this is before it even just fell off the cliff. So they bought it. Now, this is an aerial view. In 1943, these buildings, I'll show you some of the buildings, they were built for shipbuilders, building Liberty ships for the war effort. And they're low slung buildings, duplexes and quads, and they were made to be demountable. They were designed to be taken down. War effort, okay, the war's over, take them down and move on. But they stayed up. And then people started renting them. And the rent went down, and trouble started. And in the 90s, this was the highest crime, highest drug rate neighborhood in all of Savannah. So everybody, after the city bought it in 2003, wanted to see it gone. Get the bulldozers out, take it down. It's blight, right? That's just kind of the backstory. So, to the city's credit, after they bought it, they're designing an Earthcraft community. Earthcraft is similar to to LEED certification, only it's designed specifically for the environment of the Southeast. Right. So, Earthcraft community, mixed use, mixed income, as green as possible. And this is what the plan will eventually look like. And then this is what it looks like presently, although this is now all gone, and over the last few months. And their plan was to bulldoze everything. And so here, like I said, I sometimes we can only give our own stories and hopefully provide a hint at the broader picture. I can tell you, I'm on the lead USGBC. I'm not an architect. I've never taken a class in architecture. Nothing like it. And I to this day, I'm like, well, why am I on? I don't know. But I think that talks a little about, or a little to, the need for external influences. Right? The whole idea of a permeable boundary. If you have systems that are only talking to themselves, everybody lives by the assumptions that have developed over the years. You need that external influence. So I was invited to come in and to help them make it greener. As a sustainability expert. And we talked about the renewables, the geothermal, the this, the that, the materials. And my question was, what are you going to do with the garbage? Because that's a lot of garbage. And they said, we don't know. Right? So that became, a year ago, the objective, not only for this new nonprofit, but also for our classes. Right? So it's a wicked problem in itself. The city wants it gone. The community wants it gone. How do we save it? And not only that, through meaning innovation, how do we make it meaningful to all the stakeholders? So this is what they look like, right? It was, and I've got pictures. I'm not showing them here, but pictures of inside. They're shocking. When I took my students walking through these things, what you saw, the residue of human trauma was everywhere. I mean, it's everywhere in these buildings. There's nothing. I mean, nothing is left to imagination. So everybody saw this, and of course they saw this, right? Because it was a blight. But we saw this. This is heart pine. 1943 they were built. The wood, the quality of this wood, is so far superior to even some hardwoods. And it's as rare as can be, right? That was all going to be landfill. So we actually, the first thing we did was give city councilmen tours. I knocked down the ceiling and I said, look. And we got a ladder and we said, look, tap on that. Because the belief was, hey, it was demountable, so it must be trash. Well, demountable in 1943 is better than a permanent home in 2010, right? And we started banging on this. They're like, oh, yeah, well, it's good wood, but it's probably rotten. Mm-hmm. No. Just around the edges. Oh, termites. No. It's termite resistant in large part. So the new, and I say the new because it's the old way we did it, right? Sustainability is about some of the things our grandparents did. You know, all right. Now this is the framework, and it just I'm not going to talk too much about this either. When I say framework, I'm going to talk about them specifically. But we, in terms of how you take something that is garbage and design 1,000 design opportunities, that was our goal. It's like, how do you turn this into a learning lab for years and for everybody? So this is kind of the general framework. Right now there's 8 initiatives, but each of these is pretty extensive, as you'll see. All right, so what role does education play within our program? Now keep in mind that this, remember, we have the traditional science and we have the traditional life cycle analysis. We have the all of those theories. This is only the social innovation area of the degree, even though, once again, that opens up opportunities for the others. So how do we
introduce students and get them to do some things. These are just some of the things that they have been doing. First initiative, whatever you want to call them, right? The Positive Deviance, the Positive Deviant Institute. They're just formalizing this idea that within every community there is the heel. There is something, there is a person or a community doing something that somehow regenerative and healthy. And how do we as designers find them? And then how do we facilitate their doing? Right? So in this case, Johnny Powers, 82 years old. He was in the Army, postman for 30 years, musician, opened up his own church, started his own church. He's got CDs, and he makes furniture. He lives in Savannah, right? So the question, we have all these materials. What do we do with them? The idea here is to find a positive deviance and to start establishing systems of cultural interaction. He built this house in 1960, and this is kind of when I say, someone who has it all together. 1960, we knocked down Union Station and we destroyed the African-American lifeblood along West Broad Street. It's called MLK now, because we got rid of the trains and we put an overpass. Right now, over the last 2 years, the city is trying to correct that. We're actually going to be taking the overpass down, but the damage has been done. Right? Now we move on, and we're actually looking at the High Line as an influence, perhaps. when everybody was, the whole community was falling apart, this man went out with his wife. He designed his own house. He's got no architecture training. Designed his own house, and he collected the bricks. He collected them when everybody else was throwing them out. He built his own house, and now he makes his own furniture. It's nice. I mean, it really works nice. It's kind of modular. These are prototypes. If you saw them up close, there's like, you can tell they're hand cut. So just through some interactions, I meet him. What are we going to do for him? And this is where, you know, when we talk about systems thinking, hopefully we can make this work, but we're going to give it a shot. You find those positive deviants. You find, and Savannah is rich with history, right? So that is one of the, let's say, the benefits of that area. How do we parlay that into something much bigger? You find these craft people. It doesn't have to be furniture. It could be any craft. You supply them, Strathmore, with these materials. And then we are doing this as we speak. We're building up an apprenticeship program. So at-risk youth, who right now are floundering on the streets, bring them in, train them through the intelligence and the creativity of a man they can really relate to, and develop a small product line. But the question always is, how small, right? It has to be sustainable. And not only that, we have to sell it. But where we have that issue, where we're solving some problems here, we have to solve this part of the problem. And so we're working with the hospitality sector, which is huge in Savannah. And we are, it's got a long way to go. I mean, I won't lie. You know, we're hammering away at it. At some of these nice hotels, we're going to get 3 or 4 pieces that Johnny builds. And there's going to be a plaque, right? Graphic design, communication design, information design, and so on. That'll say, Johnny Powers, tell a little story, design this. And these are the 3 individuals who are working in his craft shop. And if you want to take the trolley to his workshop, you can get it downstairs. So taking advantage of this tourist industry in Savannah, which is really big, but it's circumscribed. It just stays within the small, beautiful area. It doesn't go out into the outlying areas. Get them to go out into those neighborhoods and meet the craftsmen. And actually come home from Savannah with something made in Savannah rather than in China. Right? So that's one of the initiatives. It's moving along. The other is, now remember, we're talking about social innovation on a few levels. That would be maybe a traditional look at social innovation, right? You change, you work with the community to nurture and amplify what they have. But another form of social innovation is dealing with all the roadblocks within the building industry between engineers and developers and so on. And so we have been working hand in hand with the developers. Here too, it's been a very difficult road. But one thing we were able to do is get within the contract for phase one, which is 39 houses, was a commitment from the literally written into the contract, 75% of the studs pulled out so we can use them for trusses in the redevelopment of the public housing.
Right? So these materials, this is after they pulled the studs out. And this, so what's, like I said, there's more than that. There's brick programs and other programs, but this one has moved along faster than the rest. And so what we've done in terms of community, meaning within the community, we had it not too long ago. I mean, we've had a number of events. We had 80 volunteers come out to denail, do nothing but denail. And so we brought in a carpenter apprenticeship program. 15 people came out. They were paid to do that, right? So they're learning a skill. They're being paid. Low-income individuals. We got the participation of the contractor and the truss manufacturer. And at the end of the day, we shipped off 770 studs, beautiful studs. And they're, as we speak, they're making trusses for the new homes. So working in the industry, and we are measuring. This is, may not seem like a lot, but once we get done with all the phases. We can measure these. And here's another thing. We're working with the city of Savannah. It's a part of the ICLEI. ICLEI is an international group of cities that are dedicated to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And there's a program where they first they do their audit, and then over the course of 4 or 5 years, they start reducing everywhere they can. So we can provide the city with a service of saying, well, you cannot, if you commit, every time you knock down a building to repurposing these tools, here's the bottom line in terms of how much carbon you can save right there to meet your goals that you've committed to. All right. Now, a lot of this has to do with hammering away at the norm, at the status quo. Constant demonstration. There's another thing that Margaret talked about. That one thing the designers can do is demonstrate. Right? We can prototype things and make it meaningful. And if we have this kind of rhythm where you have these change ideas being brought out to the community, they actually can be turned into change actions. Small actions, maybe. Those small actions change a few more minds. And so the amplification and the rhythm. And I guess one reason why I put this up here is because I know it can be very frustrating. Over the years, you can sometimes think, like, oh, getting anywhere. But you know what? Then you talk to people and they're like, you know what you did the last year or something like that was so awesome. And they talk to somebody. I know that sounds cliche, maybe even too simple, but it's real. This is how sustainability will be deeply infused within our culture, right? We weren't, yeah. I was going to go back to the grandmothers, but,
Yeah.
Right. We were
not in the place we are now, even 20 years ago. 80 years ago, certainly, but even 20 years ago.
The depression brought about. I mean, that was the beginning of sustainability. My parents still live like that.
Right, with the tin foil.
Whose parents were actually victims of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So all we need now, and we're on our road to it, is another Great Depression, and it's coming.
Yeah.
That's why you're doing this.
Well, not, that's not my motivation. Honestly, it's not. It isn't. I'm aware of that, but that's not my motivation. Right.
My parents still live in the house that my father did.
Yeah. I would tell my
grandmother.
Oh, cool. I tell my grandmother, like, you guys had it right, you know, when we talked about this. And she said, we didn't have a choice. Another example of how, like, this one deconstruction thing that would have been a demo thing is, now we're talking about perception. This is a butt-ugly strip mall. Americana, down to its core, you got, like, and they're all cool, good people, so I'm not knocking them. Like, a down-home barbecue joint right here. You got a liquor store owned by, like, a 20 generations of moonshine makers. You've got a pizza place run by a guy from New Jersey who's making some really good pizza, but it's really down-home stuff, right? So here, it's ugly as sin. Here, this is like this big old, this is not Savannah, but Savannah, when I say not Savannah, this is not what Savannah looks like. Yet this is only 4 miles from downtown. So as soon as you get outside of Savannah, you see this, right? You see this legacy of sprawl. So it's fine to put solar panels on, let's say, an organic coffee shop, right? That's great. Does it change anybody's mind? Not usually. Because the coffee shop people are like, yeah. You know, and the people who are resistant to these ideas are like, yeah, of course, they're hideous, right? So it's good. It's great. But if we really want to start changing minds, we got to make it meaningful to these guys, right?
We got to make it meaningful on the terms of our society as our society exists. So we figured, hey, now here, this is interesting. This is our first green certified restaurant in Savannah, and she chose to own a spot right here. Because both of these roads, go right out to Tybee Island. Tybee Island is a barrier island. So there's a lot of traffic here. But nobody stops here unless they eat booze, right? So she's like, well, you know, I think I can manage my business by being there. And we went to talk to her, and we saw her as a wedge, right? Like literally as, okay, well, here's that positive deviant again. Here's somebody who's doing something. She's profiting. She's making good money. She's speaking on their terms in terms of business and profit and all of that. So why not literally use that as the beginning of a ripple of sustainability on the terms of these people. So this is what it looks like here. There it is. And we're working on this. Now what I mean by that, the traditional contextual research, we went and we sat down, we didn't talk about sustainability at all. We wanted to learn about their businesses and we talked to them. We sat down, we ate there, we gained their trust, we worked, we played with them. I mean, you know, there's real relationships there. More importantly, there's a real understanding of what's driving them. These are small business owners with a lot at stake, and they work their asses off. Excuse me. They really do. So they're good people. They think sustainability, this is the South, so they think sustainability is some crazy liberal agenda kind of thing, right? I mean, they really are the epitomize that resistance to sustainability because it's framed like hippie stuff. So that was when I say green them on their own terms, right? Not on our terms. It's not what we think, it's what they think. So these are, so I want to make sure I keep moving.
I want to save some time.
Okay. All right. So we use some, you know, kind of business tools and we applied their business needs to sustainable opportunities. We bring in, get the system into the room. That's the founder of USGBC, systems thinking, collaboration, and so on. We brought in VPs of solar companies. We brought the restaurant owners into the class. After we came up with some ideas, we brought them in. We talked to the county about where their bike paths are going to go and how we could get the Savannah Bike Campaign to advocate for more cycling in that area and so on. Educational center for composting. We really started to look at what was available. This is all going to be reclaimed materials. Hopefully we'll have this built within 3 or 4 months. But the idea is to make it a more appealing place to go. And then as we learn, as we spent time with them, the property manager had started to tell us that she has a tremendous flooding problem. So she was initially totally resistant to that. I mean, she said, no. She said, I need every parking spot because by law I can't have any more. And we looked out back and we said, well, you know, you can park on the grass. You can actually define parking spots on the grass. And we remeasured the parking spots. We realized that they could lose an inch on each one, and that supplied a few more. But most importantly, we realized that just because she has massive flooding issues back here with a very simple permeable pavers application, we could apply for, we're in the middle of it right now, an $800,000 grant to green, not just create a green roof, but create bioswales, either the whole thing is permeable pavers or just parts. So we're providing them a lot of options. We never would have known that if we had gone in and made assumptions. One of the things that we also did is open up, the property manager is so happy about it, she opened up one of her vacant stores, and we had this huge party, 400 people. We had like all the ideas, and we asked the entire community to tell us what we forgot, what we did wrong, and so on. So we got conflict elaboration, collaboration, and in true sense. All right, now, just quickly kind of maybe a theoretical underpinning. I mentioned that this is a movement. We look at social movement theory. We look at some of the roles because there's always like, well, no, the person throwing tomatoes, they're really ruining this. Well, and then the reformer, the person who's working with the industry, they're seen as sellouts. Right, so you have all these conflicts within the movement, and everybody's fighting because, no, the way I do it is right, and they're doing it wrong. Well, Bill Moore, not the now Bill Moore, but Bill Moore is who's been involved with a lot of civil rights, gay rights, nuclear disarmament, all of that. He's developed this beautiful MAT, what he calls MAT, Movement Action Plan. And we teach this because we have to tell him that not only do you have to play these different roles, but you have to know when you should be playing them, and you have to support the other ones. And of course, what he lays out are the negative roles. There's always a negative rebel. There's always a negative reformer. Well, so I think this is very helpful. And then this, I'm going to go through this. This is more like it. He defines normal times, proof failure of official institutions, ripening conditions, takeoff, perception of failure, majority public opinion, success, and of course, always continuing the struggle. So he's laid out this beautiful plan that I think as sustainability advocates, we can learn from and use to help people make sense of the continuity needed and the length of time required to make this truly deep. So this and this is his layout of how each of the players get active depending on what period of time. Like I said, I won't go into all the details, but it's a really nice plan. Trigger events can be positive or negative. Exxon Valdez, something like that. Or the Clean Water Act. Right, so it could be on either end. Moore lays out civil rights really nicely in terms of how it plugged in. And I'm not going to, like I said, I only showed one slide from this. This is from a lecture that I give to the students. But within this idea of ripening conditions, the different things that are happening by different players, right? The nest is like being shaken, even though, I think the biggest thing here is what we have to do is proof failure of official institutions. Prove and official institutions, whether it be government or corporations, make sure that what they say and what they're doing, people see the disparity there. I mean, we have to make sure we can do that. I'm going to continue here really quickly. We are partnering with the Girl Scouts. We're building a LEED certified eco village on this beautiful island, and we are supplying all the materials. So this is another way, work with other nonprofits already have a lot of power. We're just facilitating. We disappear in this process. When I say we, I mean my students, and I mean the nonprofit. We have demonstrated. We took down two buildings, and people saw these trusses, and they were blown away. We had engineers and developers coming out saying, I can't believe this, the quality of this wood. We are quantifying all the materials that we're taking down, so providing that kind of a service. This is one after we reclaimed probably about 75% of the building. And then this is what's happening. So we did this on 3 days. It was 98 degrees. It was hell, but it was fun. These are the trusses. Some of the trusses in Athens, Georgia. A month later, we built a pavilion. And when I say we, remember, I'm just helping the Girl Scouts do what they want to do. So demonstration. And we had a legacy charrette with the AIA, and then it's moving into a design and build for this eco center out. And all right, now graphic design, maybe 3 minutes, 5 minutes? Is that or am I done?
Well,
should
no,
I be done?
Take 3 minutes. I want to just take some time.
Yeah, okay. All right. Advocate for the people who are doing it already, right? So we just created a symbol, and we give it to people who are doing some cool things. And in this case, this is the story. So we're telling stories. I have the chart here. All right, so I'll go back to that. 1870, these pilings were put down in the Savannah River. They came up in 2008. They were going to be trashed, right? A real genius kind of a material reclaimer, like this guy who just forged everything. He cut all of it into a planter. So we can tell a story from the pilings. This, as you can see, 06, they were there, they were going to be just wiped out. They were saved, they were cut into lumber, and they were turned into a planter. So there'll be a plaque here that says, this is a person who's doing an amazing job. We had nothing to do with it, right? But we want to advocate for them. Here's another way to advocate, right? Reinvent, right? So this is predictable, right? Mm-hmm. Wood to wood. This is not so predictable. A bow tie. This is made from Strathmore materials. So boat fashion, right? So here it is. This ain't junk. This is a campaign. It's a wooden bow tie. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful wooden bow tie. One of our grad students made it, and he's made a small-scale production line, and he's giving those away to raise awareness of the value of materials.
And so this is a belt buckle, and this ain't junk. So kind of playful, somewhat provocative, reimagining how we reuse materials. We've had public harvest days where they tell us what they're going to build. We open up the doors. They take what they want. She says she's going to build an off-grid kitchen. When she's making it, she takes pictures, and we tell her story. Photographers to come in to the show. We're having a symposium on reclaimed materials, inviting all kinds of people, historians, talking about the shipbuilders and all the families that lived there. This is some of the frameworks in terms of what some of the classes. You can see the continuity, fall 09, winter 2010, spring 2010, summer 2010. These are the things that these classes, through a lot of collaboration and a lot of hard work, have been able to accomplish. And then these are classes, by the way, created such a buzz that students and professors are like, what can we do? Right? So these black ones are never thought about it. They came to us and said, what can we do to contribute? So they made some real cool videos and furniture for phase one. Science, and I want to say science, real measurements. What we're trying to do is let everybody know that if they go reclaim materials, it's not going to be a wild guess. Right. So what we've done, we've gone out and we've measured everything. We know exactly how many studs are within these trusses and how thick they are and what measurements. So we can, over the next 2.5 years, have people give us a shopping list. And we can bring together 2 shopping lists and say, okay, on November 10th, we're going to take one building down and half of it will go here, half of it will go there. So enabling this digestion. These are some concept maps. We're out on the streets. We're doing stuff to raise awareness and make it real. Just the top of systems and so on. So this is at my end, thank you. So the idea here, and once again, you know, like to kind of look at it, the one thing that you do in a class or as a student, I think you, as long as we're not defining it as one thing, as much as one thing within a larger system, and then much like Wendell Berry says, solving for pattern, we have to solve for pattern. We have to figure out ways where the one thing that we attempt to fix doesn't create negative ripples, right? Create other problems, as much as ripple in a positive way that actually start healing other things. We have to be able to anticipate in some way those things. So our philosophy is it's not a board. It's not a piece of wood. It's a springboard, right? Just to kind of to focus that. And then this has grown very fast. We've been asked by FEMA. Now, this is early, too. It's a long story. I think we could stop here. But a lot of really crazy, interesting things have happened just because we said, can we get some materials out of one building? You know. All right. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. And that's that. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you have some questions of Scott. He is going to join our faculty panel right after this, but I thought I would maybe open this up for a few minutes if there were some direct questions. Yeah, I was wondering whether any of the interior designers department.
Do you run into issues? I mean, cost is always the biggest issue for anything, for anybody trying to do something or change. Do you run into cost issues, or have you found that government funding is enough, or is SCAD doing something, or how are you getting monies to kind of go forward?
Right. We're not getting money from SCAD, although okay. They're really happy with what we're doing. That probably is the most important question, right? How do we make it economically feasible? And I think, you know, we see both the nonprofit and the class as a buffer to learn about processes to make them more efficient and more attractive to the stakeholders. So the contractor who committed, this is where he was very, very brave. He said, well, I've got to build these, you know, these new these houses, and I got a timeline, and I got a budget, and you're telling me that you want to take old wood and turn it into trusses. And so we had, more or less as a nonprofit, promise that we would create a buffer. Right? We would pull in. But see, the beauty of this is 80 volunteers for one, about 70 for another. The press loves it. So the contractor's like, well, yeah, we had to bring out this machine, we had to do this, we had to do that, but everybody's talking about it. But then there's also innovative funding. I mean, we're looking at some major grants. And I think in the end, when we can quantify the value, and I think the answer is many different ways. work with the county government, work with the state government to create maybe a more equitable, let's say, financial structure. That's long-term, but it has to be happening now. So it's on every level. And once again, I'm not saying that we're succeeding at all of them, but we're trying to do that.
On the ground level, if you're talking about reinvigorating, renewing, and restoring as opposed to demolishing and dumping, you talked about meeting these people at the strip mall and getting to know them a little bit. And one of the things I'm interested in hearing more about is how to make it look more like it's something that's community and value-oriented as opposed to a lefty liberal, you know, agenda, because I think that a lot of this is politicized. Don't you think that's an impediment?
It is an impediment, but that was it's another, actually, those are two of the biggest things is, everything we did there was not about sustainability, it was about their bottom line. So when we talked about composting, because there's a lot of stuff I didn't talk about there, the facilities, for instance, the property manager was paying, I don't know how much, every year because of her stormwater drainage problems. And she knew that if she solved it, she would have to pay, I think, like $1.2 million to solve the drainage. So she's like, well, I'd rather pay the fees than to fix it. And we come in and we're like, well, you can fix it at a lower cost and you don't have to deal with the regulation. So, you know, the whole natural capital where you're tunneling through the cost barrier, that idea of, well, let's look at the whole system and optimize the whole system. So, and then with the property, the business owners, it was like, all right, well, how much do you pay every month for garbage disposal? And they gave us the numbers. You know, and then we said, well, you know, Wendy, she wants a compost, and she's willing to start, and she's giving it to Oatland Island, which is an education facility. So we're prototyping compost collection, and that reduces the waste costs for the business owners. So we have framed everything in economic fashion.
Intangibles. So, but just like one follow-up, though. So you came from New York 10 years ago and went to Savannah. So they must have been looking at you sideways, too, when you got off the boat, so to speak.
I know how to say y'all.
That's about all you knew at the time. But in terms of the transitioning, you know, because that's a lot of what it is. It doesn't have to be from New York to Savannah. It can just be from one state of consciousness to another.
Right.
You know, so how did you deal with that? Because
on
must
their
have
terms.
Thought you were people all lefty.
Right. On their terms. That's a really good question. But, I mean, you know, I hear, like, collaboration and, you know, it on their terms. We listen. We didn't even like when we created solutions, it was like, here's some ideas. What do you think? You know, this, it'll save you this. But that's difficult. It's really a challenge and it's a day-to-day struggle. But you know, when you see them turn on, we turn on. You know, it's like, wow, okay. So they're finding those commonalities here too. I know that sounds hokey, but you know, with empathy, I mean, empathy has become like a dirty word. Right? It's a soft word.
Yeah. Now, how do you translate that into the curriculum? How do you build these activities into the students' life?
Mm-hmm.
You cannot count ahead of time that this will be such a great experience that you can give the students credits for.
Yeah.
You cannot count that they will be gung-ho and willing to volunteer all their time and work with the community.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go
there? Right. Good question. If you're teaching systems thinking, you have to give them the opportunity to work within a very complex system.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can teach them Dinella Meadows, right? You can teach them Laszlo and all of that. You can give, we sit down, we read all of that. But in order for them, so like success within a class within 10 weeks, I throw a situation at them and I don't care about the outcome. I literally don't. Now, I know there has to be an outcome and it has to be measurable in some way. But this is where when we talk about changing curriculum, we have to say, success within a system doesn't mean here to there. It just means somewhere out here. You know, and so it's about like giving them all of these people, throwing them into a mess. I bring city aldermen, like I said, the county government, city government, the MPC, the planning commissions. We go out and we talk to them and we move towards an end. Another time with environmental justice, we realized about 4 weeks in that our best solution was a presentation to the regional head of the EPA. And so we worked towards that, because only because we had learned what the trigger points were. So it's a different way of creating metrics, let's say, and a rubric. But the rubric is adaptability, ingenuity within dynamic systems, perceptive abilities within the opportunities, not just one, right? The many opportunities that lie ahead. It's a challenge, right?
How do you fail students from the course?
How fail?
They get
ready. They know, like in the beginning, we have a lot of talks about systems, and if they're incapable of not changing their viewpoints in convincing manner, in other words, if the evidence is all there and they're still resistant, and they come from architecture and they want to build a building, it's not going to work. So it's based upon the ability to A, assess opportunities, B, make something of, let's say, concrete value, even if it's a slideshow, that expresses a way forward, to working within this a system.
Or they get recycled.
How many students are involved in this? The we is a sort of a critical piece of the story.
Yeah.
It's a ballpark.
Yeah. Every quarter it grows. In the beginning, I should say too that the master's program, three of us designed it, and we got it through curriculum council about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago. Our first MA graduates, we have an MA program, which is kind of professional program. It's like 15 credits, pretty short, and then an MFA, 15 and 45. And if you look at this, for instance, in the beginning, listen, when I say in the beginning, it's not that long, right? Mm-hmm. The summer, we had some stuff going on. There's myself, Ursula Tischner, who's joined us, a German expert in sustainability. She's become a major part of it. And then some of these classes are from outside of sustainable design. So this was, these are a lot, most, let's say, these are my classes. Mm-hmm. That's Kathy's, who is also involved. But these are other people. And it is a movement. People, you know, are drawn into it. I don't think we want a really big program, but I think we probably would like to get another person in there, someone who, at least one more, and then keep the, I know SCAD likes to grow, but we want, right now we have 14 in the program. But a lot of the applied theories classes and the practices classes are cross-listed with design management. So half the practices class is either design management or architecture or furniture.
How do you discuss skin?
That's a good question. We haven't done it yet.
No?
Nope. And I don't know.
Mm-hmm. You're starting to talk about where your students are coming from, but where are they coming from? What kind of background do they have?
Mm-hmm.
You talk about architecture, you talk about furniture design.
Yeah.
How diverse is your student population? How old are they?
Diverse. We have interior design, industrial design, architecture, but we also have journalism. And let's see, what else do we have? Someone who's 40 and he was a paint for Benjamin Moore. He's a color expert, you know. But and then we have like a few that come out of an undergraduate program. So it's a really diverse and because the classes are interdisciplinary. I don't want to go all the way back to that. Maybe I will. Because there are a lot of them are interdisciplinary in nature. We put calls out to different departments. And we get, and you know, we get some, in the beginning, we get some resistance. It's like, well, no, this is not what sustainability is. In fact, every quarter, there's at least three people who come in on the first day, they're like, oh, I know, this is going to be an easy class. And within 3 weeks, they're like, wow. You know, so, yeah, but to answer your question, diverse. Yeah. So.
I have one point, and I've seen renovations, I've seen restorations, I've seen salvaging many places. There's one point of the picture that I'm not seeing at this point. The building you built, that was built for the Girl Scouts, what happens in 50 years? What happens in 100 years? Has anybody made any studies as to these parts are sustainable? These parts need to be put together differently. These can be taken apart again. Is there any sort of the third step? right. problems right. in the building then. What happens 100 years from now for these? So the same sustainability process.
Right. So the longevity of the artifacts that we make. Yeah. Well, that I mean that's a small pavilion. That's a big part of it in terms of what we've been at, like the Girl Scouts camp. So right now, if we look at some of the projects, there's that, which you can't really call a building. It was a what do you call it? A pavilion. Mm-hmm. It's was there more attention paid to other, you know, like let's say this longevity, not necessarily there because it was a Girl Scouts. I think once we get like the other Girl Scouts, the Eco Village, the camp, we're looking at something that is intended to last for another 100. Intended. And we'll do everything we can to advocate for ways in which to build materials which to use in that area that can do that. When I say another 100, it's a nice marker for us because the Girl Scouts have been around for exactly 100 years. 2012 is their centennial. So our goal is to say in another 100 years this building will still be here as an exemplification of sustainability. But yeah, it's an important question. Yeah. I hope that answered a little.
It does. It's usually a point where you get about the planters. How long can I expect my planter to look like that
right.
before it cracks through or something? These
right.
are the points that
yeah.
we build, but we don't think of what can we do with that space in 40 years or 100 years. Maybe it has a multiple use that we don't know about.
Right, right. Secondary use, yeah. And designed for environment or designed for rebuild. Yeah.
Scott, you begin your presentation with the image of a little boy. Later on, you talked about that destitute community and with the right temporary housing, the city buys that tract.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to all of your efforts and the architecture and the systems, I think about the little boy and the people who were living there.
Mm-hmm.
We've all of a sudden got government action, we've got nonprofit action, but what happens with the people? Literally, what happened to the people? Do you know?
In that particular case, where is it? In that particular case, the Earthcraft community guidelines are about long-lasting buildings. So Earthcraft, like I said, is about southeast high humidity, occasional high winds, and so on. So those things are addressed. And in terms of community, this will be. It is. And it will be the first phase, which is this area here, and they just broke ground. It's right because they switched this already. It's right about here. Is affordable housing. So the city in this, and your question, I think here we see it. It's going to be exemplified: mixed use, mixed income, and that really is saying that the low economic ladder will be served through this, and that was the whole intention with the city. But your question in terms of like maybe in the future, like what role do we play? Yeah.
Are we creating this great grassroots activist movement,
mm-hmm.
but only feeding a certain echelon?
And
that's when I think of sustainability. That's what I think about because if it's not really supporting
right.
these
right.
communities, I think
it's an important point always to remember. And that to that point, like these ideas where this is all about nurturing that community,
absolutely.
But we have found that that every time we go to these meetings. There is that pressure to say, well, what about, you know, the industry? What about this? And so it's a constant, I think anyone who's worked in the nonprofit world knows that, that tension between what society's driving through, business mindset and what the community really needs. That's a battle that's being fought every single day.
It's the conflict. Yeah.